On RN, the Philosopher's Zone, Joe Gelonesi with you. Good to have you with us again. Today, The Social Network.
I really think that the cultural impacts of social media are so deep and pervasive that it's necessary at this time for philosophers to be thinking about social media ethics. What does it mean to be a virtuous agent online? How can we use social media to really thrive? These are really important questions today, given the scale and speed of adoption of these new social tools.
Some big questions on a movement we've yet to fully come to grips with. For Tim Rayner, it warrants serious consideration, and he's doing just that, teaching university-level courses on the philosophy of social media, exploring it within the history of ideas. He's roused some scepticism, but maintains that unprecedented times call for fresh insights, and philosophy can provide the framework. It probably helps that he's a self-confessed social media enthusiast. At his place, the alarm clock rings and industry begins.
Well, I brew a pot of coffee. I sit down in front of my computer, prepare to write, and then usually I spend an hour or so trying to read the entire internet. I have to work hard to stay off social media, to be honest, because it can be a trap. It does drag you in. And of course, the content is... It's a torrent. It's a river of information. So once you're caught up there in the river, it's very hard to pull yourself out of it sometimes.
You have an excuse because your official courses at university, the ones you teach, are about social media. Just tell me about the rich philosophical veins that run underneath social media that track back to the 60s.
I think that we are rediscovering some aspects of the 60s counterculture at this point of time. I think we've been dipping back into the counterculture for a couple of generations now in different ways. But social media is really drawing on the spirit of personal development through experimentation and exploration that inspired the countercultural revolutionaries. And also it is rebooting, I suppose, the communal spirit of the counterculture. I think the counterculture was a very strange social experiment because you saw this mashup of a radical libertarianism as people broke away from mainstream culture in pursuit of very odd and singular ways of life. But that was married with a spirit of sharing and communalism. And these are two things that are being rediscovered and explored in the online world thanks to all these incredible new social media systems today.
And the work of Deleuze, tell me about his work and why that's important to this.
Deleuze was writing during the events of May 68, and his work after 68 was very much a reflection on what had happened there. For Deleuze, the spirit of the counterculture was the spirit of what he called nomadism. And nomadism is a desire to shake off the shackles and restraints of mainstream dominant culture and freely explore new ways of life, experimenting with new challenges and discovering new forms of personal and social possibility. I think that the spirit of nomadism was extremely important to the countercultural revolutionaries in the 60s, and likewise, I think it's become an important value for the youth of today as they base their lives around social sharing online.
So you see it coming out of that counterculture period, the upheaval, as it were, in the contemporary world. Foucault, tell me about where Foucault's philosophy underlies some of this.
Right, right. Foucault believed that the self was fluid. He never went as far as to claim that the self was a pure artifice, but he was very much in favor of what he called an art of life, a work upon the self in the attempt to recreate oneself and flourish. This is why he went back to the ancient philosophers in his later work, because he was really impressed by how they understood the self as a kind of work of art in progress. What is that? What is the line from Plotinus? It's never stop sculpting your own statue. That's right. That's a kind of a crystallization of this idea of the art of life. But Foucault makes the point that this work of the self in the pursuit of beauty and flourishing was a cultural phenomenon. It wasn't something that was just restricted to a few philosophers. And he felt that if we recover this cultural approach to identity, it would enable us to perhaps overcome some of the impasses that recent social liberation movements have run up against, the feminist movement, the gay and lesbian rights movement. These movements are made of people who have broken away from mainstream culture but found themselves ultimately trapped within the world of the mainstream, incapable of defining themselves as something unique and yet distinct from that mainstream. So Foucault said, well, look, these people have to learn to see the self as an experiment and a work of art, something that's constantly forged and sculpted. So keep on sculpting that statue, he would say. Keep on chipping away at it. Don't fall into the trap of just assuming that what you are today is the ultimate expression of your person.
Mm. He was also interested in the panopticon, wasn't he? The, you know, being watched, right, but not being able to tell that you're being watched, but yes, in some way trying to behave as if you're being watched.
Yes.
Do you see social media as being an extension of that?
Absolutely. Before responding to that, though, I feel it's important to make a distinction between what we might call social media 1.0 and social media 2.0. Up until about 2004, with the launch of Facebook, most of social engagement online was anonymous. You go to a chat room, you'd enter a user identity, which could be any name, and then you would just engage in exchange and conversation with the people that you met there, who were more or less strangers. And the anonymity of that experience enabled people to create themselves in various ways, but there were no limits or constraints on what one could become. And so the culture was very much one of constructing a virtual identity that was distinct from one's real world identity. Since the rise of Facebook, or since the launch of Facebook in 2004, social media has changed a great deal. Because of the success of Facebook, many subsequent social media sites have followed Facebook's lead in encouraging users to identify themselves as the real people they are, and to use that real identity as a basis for creating themselves online. And I think this really changes the nature of the social media experience. For a start, it leads people to worry about their personal reputation in a way that they never did previously. If I'm going online and I'm identifying myself as who I am, I have to think very carefully about the kinds of things I say and the kinds of things I share for fear of giving an impression of myself and my self-identity that I do not believe is authentic. So there's a kind of a reputation game and an authenticity game that is created by virtue of the fact that we are expected to be our or present ourselves in terms of our real identities online. Now, I think Foucault's idea of the panopticon is very useful for reflecting on how the experience of exposing oneself as an identity online fills us with anxiety and can make us worry a great deal about our personal reputation, such that the construction of reputation can, for some people, become the single overriding task when they go online. The panopticon, as you know, was devised by the British philosopher and social reformer Jeremy Bentham, essentially is a design for the perfect prison. And the structure was a ring of cells surrounding a central guard tower. All the prisoners in the cells were visible to the guards in the tower, but the opposite was not the case. The prisoners in the cells were never entirely sure whether they were being watched at any one time. And as Foucault points out, this sets up a kind of psychological dynamic, such that the prisoner comes to act as if they were being watched irrespective of whether there's any sign that they are actually being watched. Foucault thinks that once a prisoner has been placed in that environment for a length of time, they will go out of the prison and behave as if they were being watched, because the sense of visibility gets under one's skin.
And is this true now, though, of social media, in the sense that you're constantly performing for, you're performing an identity or multiple identities for a known or unknown group of people who are watching?
Well, I think it is. There are plenty of people, particularly young people, who go online and do not give a thought to what it entails to upload information and share information on themselves. But I think most adult users, particularly people who are concerned about their reputation online, are very much aware that everything that they post or tweet or pin or whatever mechanism of sharing one is using, everything that is shared is essentially being made visible to a crowd of followers, which can be quite extensive. Now, all those people effectively evaluate what is shared. The word judge is probably too severe, but certainly people evaluate what is shared. If they like it, they may share it themselves. If they don't like it, they just ignore it. But for the individual user, the experience is one of exposing oneself, exposing one's interests and one's values, one's points of view, in a situation of extreme visibility. So I think social media does set up a kind of virtual panopticon. And just as prisoners in a real panopticon will fashion themselves and limit their behavior to meet the norms and expectations of the institution, so too do users of social media fashion and limit and occasionally exaggerate and accentuate themselves, so to play up to the expectations of their followers.
Mm. That would have been of interest to Foucault, the performance or the performativity of that culture. Do you think, though, there is a deep conformism in that, even though it looks like you're experimenting, moulding, sculpting, you know, the sculpture is never finished? In the end, though, is that swarm making you into something perhaps you're not or unwilling to be, or perhaps being pushed into an identity which is not you?
It's a very interesting question. I think there are lots of aspects to be addressed there. But essentially, I think that increasingly people are using social media to create different identities that play to or appeal to different kinds of social groups. For example, your average social media user today is probably on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, or Facebook and LinkedIn for most professionals. Those are two very different communities, and each the Facebook crowd has a very different set of values and expectations based on the kind of social commerce that goes on the system than the LinkedIn crowd does. Obviously, LinkedIn is much more professional and business-oriented. So I think your average social media user, if he or she was just using these two systems, will essentially come to create a different kind of identity on each system. On Facebook, the identity will be more of the social self, and on LinkedIn, obviously, the identity will be the professional self. Does that amount to inauthenticity? As I say, I think there's lots to be discussed there, and it's a very interesting topic.
Hello, Twitter bird. Tweet a little tweet on Twitter. Any little thing will do.
Every single tweet's a winner. You can do it too.
Yes, tweet a little tweet on Twitter. Everyone will know what's new.
Tweet a little tweet. It's up to you. In 140 characters, I'll tell you what I eat.
On Twitter, I post random artsy pictures of my feet. I'm staying up to date with friends while walking down the street.
Yeah, Twitter's pretty sweet.
I'm literally Twitter.
Initial feeling is that it doesn't need to be an inauthentic way of being. We we do have different aspects to ourselves. In the course of the average day, we tend to slip in and out of a number of different identities. We go from home life to professional life to social life. And these are like different shades of the same person. Psychologist Sherry Turkle has this idea of the prismatic self. Ourselves are prismatic. They are multidimensional. And I think one thing that's very interesting about social media is that it does encourage us to foster a prismatic self. There's a professional side to ourself that we develop on LinkedIn, a social side we develop on Facebook. On Twitter, well, it's hard to say exactly what side of the self one's developing on Twitter. That reflects the nature of the community, I think. But it comes down to the necessity for the individual, if the individual is actually to have a successful and popular time on one of these social systems, that the individual needs to play to the crowd that's on the that particular system, which doesn't necessarily mean conforming, but it does mean playing to the kinds of values and expectations that predominate in that particular environment. But one other thing I'd say about that is that when reflecting on these kinds of issues, I think it's important to consider how the conditions of life have changed in the past 200-150 years. Prior to the industrial age, people lived in small communities. They didn't travel. Their experience of the rest of the world was very limited. And they took up a trade or an occupation, and they just stuck with it their whole life. Of course, we live in quite very extremely different times. People today, well, very few people in the Western world can hope to actually take a single line of work and stick with it their entire life. And the opportunities for movement, for travel, for retraining, for exploration of new ideas are just manifold. So I think that authenticity remains a vital topic for us today. But when thinking about authenticity, we have to acknowledge the conditions of life have changed. It's simply no good to appeal to some kind of pre-modern or early modern experience and use that as an example of the ideal life. Instead, we have to look at the conditions of life that we're dealing with and struggling with at this point of time and say, well, how can we make meaning? How can we find authenticity and purpose under these conditions? That's a major challenge.
Tim Rayner, taking social media seriously in the history of ideas. And he's on the Philosopher's Zone here on RN. You see it as a gift culture that the sharing on social media can't be underestimated for its power of gifting, as it were. Tell me what you mean by that.
I've been thinking about social media since 2007, 2008, and trying to find philosophical models that would cast some light on the culture of sharing and exchange that goes on online. And to be honest, I could not find those models from the Western philosophical tradition. I think the Western tradition is, from Socrates and Plato, is highly individualistic. And of course, in our broader culture, we're very much enamored with the culture of possessive individualism, pretty much the backbone of our Western cultural way of being. I think social media is really disrupting that in a major way, because at the heart of social media, we have the phenomenon of social sharing. So to understand social sharing, I had to look beyond Western cultural frameworks, and I found that indigenous gift cultures from about the world proved to be really enlightening for understanding the value of social sharing and what people enjoy about it, what they find empowering about it. So just as an example, when I'm talking about social sharing online and how people use social media to create their reputation, I tend to refer to the North American Indian potlatch ceremony. And the potlatch was essentially a gift-giving ceremony. A chief would call a potlatch And the idea was to present the tribe with an incredible gift, which would consist of canoes and furs and weapons and crafts. Sometimes a number of chiefs would compete with one another at a potlatch by trying to outgive one another, essentially. Why would these people give away so much? It wasn't simply altruism. It's agreed that the primary motivator for the potlatch ceremony was the pursuit of prestige. The more that the chief gives to the tribe, the more prestige they receive for it, and the more their reputation is enhanced as a result. I think we're doing this a very similar thing on social media. Serious and regular users of social media are essentially trying to outgive each other for the sake of personal reputation. Now, that sounds rather self-serving, and the idea of giving for the sake of receiving prestige sounds fairly self-serving and egotistical. But the interesting thing, well, the lesson that we learn from the potlatch is that in that traditional environment, there was really no clear distinction between individual self-interest and communal benefit. The chief would receive prestige for the gifts, but the tribe would benefit. And part of the reputation that the chief would gain as a result of giving was tied up with the indication that they cared about the tribe, that they wanted to enhance the tribe's welfare and well-being and strengthen the bonds of kinship and tribal solidarity. So again, I don't believe that we're necessarily giving out of self-interest on social media. I think that in the ethical case, I would say, people are giving on social media for the sake of their personal reputation, but also for the sake of building strong social ties, strong social networks, or what some commentators call tribes online. So it's a completely different cultural framework, and that involving a whole series of different ways of thinking about social sharing.
Are you worried that the sharing in social media is actually an act of narcissism? It's an act back into one rather than outwards?
Well, it can be. Social media is driving some pretty rapid changes through our societies. Obviously, it's transforming the way that we work and the way that we socialize. It's also transforming our cultural state of being. That is to say, it's transforming our values and our expectations concerning each other. I think it's necessary at this point of time for philosophers in particular to be thinking about social media best practice, essentially. That sounds like the kind of thing that, I don't know, a social media PR person might be interested in. But I really think that the cultural impacts of social media are so deep and pervasive that it's necessary at this time for philosophers to be thinking about social media ethics. What does it mean to be a virtuous agent online? How can we use social media so to deepen our sense of authenticity rather than reduce it? How can we use social media to develop strong relationships with people we know and people we don't? How can we use social media to really thrive in our lives? I mean, I think these are really important questions today, given the scale and speed of adoption of these new social tools.
Philosopher, educator, and social media enthusiast, Dr. Timothy Rayner, developing a philosophical approach to the study of online social networking, its impact on ethics, values, and personal identity, among other big-ticket conceptual items. And speaking of online, quickest and easiest way to hear this program again is to visit our page, where you can stream or download at your leisure. And of course, you can share it too. Go to the RN front page and find the program on the menu. The Philosopher's Zone is produced by Diane Dean. Technical production today by Martin Peralta. I'm Joe Gelonesi. Thanks for your company. See you next week.
I can hear gunshots, very loud shots.
Egypt is in turmoil tonight after the country's military removed the nation's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi.
The battle for power in Egypt between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood is not new. It's a struggle that goes back to the 1950s.
Authorities had to restore security, but the Muslim Brotherhood says it was a massacre.
The story of the most significant relationship in Egyptian politics. You can download this program from the Rear Vision Special Features page.